Today is Wednesday. It's April 17th, 2024, and it's 2:38 in the afternoon. And hi, this is John Williams, and you are listening to The Mincing Rascals. Portions of this broadcast, Saturday nights now at WGN Radio. And send us your email if you'd like to comment, have us respond to a question or a topic per se. Just email me, johnwilliams@wgnradio.com, and we'll share some of your comments on upcoming podcasts. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Kate Plies, a former Chicago reporter columnist, now writing the Chicago history website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
John Hansen of WGN Radio and Block Club Chicago.
I'm Austin Bird from the Illinois Policy Institute, and you can buy my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Eric Zorn, the sole writer of the Picayune Sentinel, a fine Substack newsletter.
Austin, I was thumbing through your book again over the weekend. You said that the city of Chicago should have an elected city attorney.
Yeah, other cities have them. Off the top of my head, I should probably refresh myself because I'm giving a talk, if anyone wants to come, at the Edgewater Library about the book this Saturday afternoon. But there are several cities that have a city attorney that is elected. And the idea there is oftentimes the chief legal counsel for the city is acting entirely in the mayor's interests rather than in the city's interests. So you see that a lot with things like money paid out to victims of police abuse or things like that, where the incentive is to minimize the political fallout for one individual rather than to actually bring about justice for the city.
What's the thrust of your talk going to be?
Good question. I got to figure it out in the morning. I usually take whatever the hottest issue is in Chicago and then work backwards from that. We will be discussing the contours of our talk in a private lunch before the talk.
Who are you appearing with?
My co-author, Ed.
And what time is this appearance?
I think it's at 2. I'll send a note to you, John. Maybe you can put it in the show notes.
Eric's planning his social calendar. It sounds like he might be.
Yeah, I'm going to be out of town, but I would like to come hear that sometime. That's an interesting presentation. And on that topic, I don't want to derail the podcast too much, but, you know, Karen Yarbrough, the city clerk, just died, and she's elected. And I'm wondering, is there some reason that we elect clerks? I don't even get it. It's like the circuit court clerk and the city clerk and the county clerk. She was a county clerk? I can't remember now. These clerks get elected to these clerical positions. It doesn't make any sense to me. Like, why wouldn't you want the mayor to appoint the most competent clerical person rather than have it be some politician looking for a toehold on the ladder?
Oh, can I say it? Because that person gets elected, and certainly in the past, then they would have a whole bunch of patronage jobs to hand out.
That's why they want the job. Why do we allow them that, I guess, is another way.
That's more my question. I'm speaking in a Pollyanna sort of way. So,
yeah, you sound like Eric, me, Eric.
I know.
It's not pretty.
Eric's point is right, where it's a good contrast with the city attorney stuff. We tend to, with the exception of the mayor, which is the big prize who has way too much power and controls way more of the city than mayors do in other cities, we get very little in the way of a citywide voice on hardly anything. Bring Chicago Home was very rare that we actually get to vote on something of substance citywide. Oftentimes the citywide elected officials are things like the clerk, or, you know, who's giving out your vehicle stamps or things like that, not people with real power.
So why do we elect them? I mean, and I know Kate's right that it's a political plum, and it's got hiring privileges and so on and patronage to hang out, but why, as a body politic, we say, well, this is a good idea. Let's have another election for another office that we don't know really what they do or what would qualify someone to be a good or a bad clerk.
Good question. I don't know the history of the specific offices why they're elected, but if it's anything like the rest of Chicago governance, these were how most cities were run at a certain point, like late 1800s, early 1900s. Almost all of them had charter movements where they rearranged who was elected, which offices held which, what kind of power, and those offices were consolidated, eliminated, or made something else. And Chicago never had that, and we still haven't had that reckoning.
By the way, we are on tangent road here. I'll just say one other thing before I get to the main topic that I wanted to get to. But you guys are making me think about that story that the Supreme Court is hearing where the former mayor or the current mayor of Portage, Indiana, there's a case about bribery or gratuities is the word that they're using. And it goes something like, the city grants a contract to somebody, and then the people that got the contract give the mayor $14,000 after the fact. But there was no quid pro quo, they say. Simply, they got the deal, and then as a thank you, they go ahead and tip the mayor $14,000 of product or services or cash, but the mayor somehow collects $14,000. And so the question before the court is that legal or not? Is that ethical? Is that a violation of the law? And the reason we're interested in that in Chicago is because with the Mike Madigan and the ComEd 4, the question is, did some of these plums that got dangled before people come before or after the fact? And the question that the justices were asking, what's a reasonable gratuity, a tip like, hey, here's a $100 dinner, we're going to go out and celebrate the contract we got, and what is unlawful? And the judges really did seem to split that hair. They were pressing the government on defining what is or is not a legal way to play the game. And it made me think about Blagojevich. It made me think about all kinds of things that happen in Chicago.
Well, isn't it also about the order of operations? Like, does the deed come first and the quote-unquote bribe second? And that's really the crux of the whole thing,
right? It is. But all right, so suppose it comes after, as it did in this case, John. But it's $14,000. Don't you think there's a wink and a nod there? Doesn't that look a little funny to you?
Yeah, but things that look funny aren't always illegal. I don't know. I mean, I didn't listen to the oral arguments, which is something I do love to do. So I'd have to dive in a little bit deeper. But I think the order of operations does kind of matter in these cases of what comes first or what comes second. Even if it smells funny, doesn't mean that it is or legally can be found to be funny.
The order of operations can certainly be maneuvered around so that it can be understood that if I approve your contract that you're going to give me a tip. So it doesn't – I know that at the Tribune, when I was at the Tribune, we had a policy and it was like the keychain policy, which was that you were not allowed to accept any present gift benefit of sort that was worth more than a keychain. Now, what's a keychain worth? You know, I don't know.
Golden
say couple bucks.
Oh,
so you know, so someone could send you a calendar or something like that. It's not a big deal. But as soon as if I would have written a column about someone and then they had sent me $14,000. If I took the money, I'd been fired, and deservedly so. That creates a really perverse set of incentives.
Yeah,
now, I get the legal question, but if you've got a mayor who knows that if he's going to, you know, approve a zoning variance or do whatever it is or give a city contract to a firm that's got a lot of money, if he knows through tradition that he's going to get a lot of money in return, that's corruption. I don't see any way to pretty it up by changing the order of when the gift is given.
Here's the Sun-Times story. Snyder, the mayor, accepted $13,000 from a trucking company after he helped engineer contracts with his city in the company's favor. And then they give him $13,000. John, what would you do if they gave you the $13,000? That's my answer. I think we.
So sometimes with things like these, there are legislative solutions. So, for example, you could say, hey, no city contractor should be allowed to give money to local politicians, right?
Yeah.
And there's only so once you get courts involved, it's always going to be this sort of gray line of what was quid pro quo and what wasn't.
Right.
And also, of course, there are ways to get around legislative stuff here too. There's so many examples of this in Springfield all the time. But I think oftentimes people rely too much on courts to sort of address corruption rather than saying, let's put some rules in place. And if people break those rules that we've set in place, then maybe we get to the justice system.
Was he still the mayor when the money?
I believe so. If he wasn't, that I wouldn't give him the $13,000 if he wasn't. But if he, if I understand what we're really talking about here, I think he was, John. But you know, and the reason that it is also just important to us, I think, is because if as a result of this, remember the Mike Madigan case is on hold right now until they determine whether or not that was lawful to give him $13,000. And if they determined that it was lawful, then a lot of the charges against Madigan go away. If this little miracle falls down from the sky, it'll just be how very Madigan of him. You know, it'll be incredible that this thing just falls in his lap and saves him.
Yeah, it's not so much Madigan that I'm worried about at this point, because he's gone and he's not going to be able to perform any more corrupt acts. It's what a ruling like that would signal to the lawmakers who are still in office, who are going to be the Madigans of the future, who are going to be able to do these kind of things with impunity. I think I can imagine a ruling that's going to not only throw a real crimp into the Madigan prosecution, but one that really makes it difficult to identify and prosecute political corruption. And it's frightening. I understand the problem with, like, where do you draw the line? When, you know, I'm taking them out to dinner. Are we all going to go to jail because I've taken them out to dinner after celebrate a contract? I get that. But they need to set some standards, and I think those standards can be realistically set.
You print people had it so much tougher than us radio guys. We had rules like that, but they were not a keychain. I forget what the value is, John, that we have to report, but it's a lot higher than nothing. Our industry used to be rife with payola and plugola, and it's not so much anymore. We're able to accept meals and tickets and things.
I'm not at John Williams' level, so I've never been offered. One day.
You know the saying, ends justify the means, where someone does something in the extreme, but we defend the action because the cause is so important. Still, the question that needs to be asked in those instances is, when doing something in the extreme, is it productive? Does it help the cause? Or is it simply an expression of frustration that can, in fact, hurt the cause? You know where I'm going with this. On Monday, people protesting the U.S. involvement in the war in Gaza, such as it is, stopped traffic going to O'Hare Airport for maybe 2.5 hours. Dozens of people were either laying down on the street or stood on I-190 off the Kennedy Expressway. Some would-be travelers left their cars and walked miles, pulling suitcases, only discovered that they missed their flights. So what do we say about this form of protest? Or as Eric said in his Picayune Sentinel, does this make you more or less likely to support or sympathize with their cause?
I mean, I certainly agree with everything you wrote, Eric, that it is not winning over hearts and minds to do this sort of thing. I think the problem is that that is not really what they're aiming for. It's more of a power play to force politicians to vote the way they want them to on this issue. So in that sense, I don't see it as a very democratic thing. It's amazing to me that they don't understand that they would be absolutely furious if this was being done by some right-wing group for some cause that they were completely against. They would not think that it should, you know, be let stand. I really am not sure that they're even trying to.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I think they know that. They just don't care.
My view is that when you make, you know, Bill and Martha miss their birthday dinner with their cousin in Omaha and leave them enraged sitting on the expressway, that you're not promoting your cause. Obviously, when you have protests, they're going to be disruptive in some way, right? You can't have a march or a big rally without blocking some sidewalks or some streets, and that happens. But those are sort of unintended consequences of large protests. Like when they had the Women's March in Washington, it closed down Washington. They didn't say, let's go to Washington and clog up all the streets and make sure people can't get around. I think that when you deliberately decide to block innocent people who are uninvolved in your cause from getting somewhere, it could be very important to them. It's a form of hostage taking. You're making these people, you're inconveniencing them deliberately. And I just don't, I mean, just perfectly strategically thinking, I don't think it's a good way to bring people to your cause, to get people to say, okay, I now see the injustice here. When you think about effective protests, you think of like sitting down at lunch counters in the South during the civil rights era, keeping your seat on the bus, or those kind of protests, or even, you know, good marches that are arranged in advance. But when you're getting out there and doing something like that, it's provocative. And I think this circles back a little bit to the flag burning conversation we had a couple weeks ago, which is you're just pissing people off. And that I don't see how that says, oh, I'm really furious right now, really inconvenienced. Maybe you've got a point. I don't see that linkage. And most of the people who responded to my post online were in line with that, but there were some who were saying, like, this is how it's done. This is how you make, you know, justice is painful, some guy said. Okay. And so that's the parameters of the debate as I see it.
I don't just get why they just don't give both sides what they want here and arrest people that sit on the highway. That would be absolutely what the protesters would want seen, images of them being rounded up and put into vans or put into cars or zip tied along the expressway. And it would be everyone who's sitting in the car wanting to get to the airport's end goal as well. It's almost a win-win to just arrest people, and it is against the law. And the city's own examples, they say persons expressing views protected by the First Amendment on the public way are required to comply with laws prohibiting physical obstruction of the movement of persons and vehicles on the public way. I mean, they were breaking the law. They should have been arrested. That's not a pretty picture. They would have gotten exactly what they wanted, and everyone would have gotten to work on time. I don't get why this was such a debate.
They should have done it quicker. They did arrest 40 people.
They did arrest him, yeah, charged with misdemeanors. But yeah, you're right. It has to be done quickly. And I guess it's a little bit of a preview of what we might expect in mid-August when the Democratic Convention comes 100%.
Preview, yeah. But yeah. You know what, John? From what I've been seeing of the ceasefire protests in general, I don't think it's true, though, that they want to get arrested. These protesters are generally outraged when they're arrested. They don't expect to be arrested. It's not civil disobedience where they're planning on that. They literally think that they legally have a right to do this. It is a huge public safety issue. That's an expressway. There are perhaps less ambulances and fire engines in that area, but I've certainly had ambulances go by me on the expressway. All kinds of medical emergencies could have happened in that time span. Not to mention people, with all those people walking on the shoulder trying to get to O'Hare.
It's amazing.
While you've got other people desperate to get away, maybe driving on the shoulder.
Well, and you're also seeing some, this happened around the country, but I had the Golden Gate Bridge and other places where they did this, the protesters did this. And I think it was Tom Cotton, the senator, who said, like we should just accelerate our cars right into the line of protesters or throw them off the bridge.
Take matters into your own hands, he said. And then he walked it back a little bit.
And as much as I can imagine people who have just this gut feeling who are really angry doing that. And it happened in Charlottesville, if you remember, that one of the right-wing guys drove his car into a crowd of people and killed a woman, killed one of the protesters. So when tempers are really running hot like that, it just seems like a really bad tactic. And this is just absolutely as independent as I can be about the justice of their cause. I mean, I don't even want to get into that because I don't think it's relevant to the question. I mean, whether I believe in it totally or disbelieve in it totally doesn't really matter. I just think if you want to have an effective protest to call attention to what's going on in Gaza, I'm all there for that. I'm all there for any protest you want to have. If you want to protest for or against abortion rights somewhere, that's fine. That's what America's all about. But America's not all about essentially taking these hostages on the highway.
Actions like this are the reason that Byron Sigcho-Lopez should have been censured by the Chicago City Council, and he should have had his leadership position taken away, because he was partnering with a group behind enemy lines, which... this is their mission statement, and this gets to what everybody has been talking about. Their goal is disruption and to throw down with police. It's not to change anyone's minds. It's to throw a wrench in the gears of the war machine. This is the mission statement from behind enemy lines. Quote, rather than engage in routinized protests that threaten no one or begging the rulers for concessions, we envision a militant anti-imperialist movement that throws wrenches in the gears of the war machine, develops anti-imperialist consciousness far and wide, deprives the empire of loyal soldiers, and aims to stop new imperialist wars through mass resistance. This is the same group that said, make 2024 as great as 1968. It said, make bruises from Chicago police batons the 2024 back to school fall fashion. They said, have you thrown down against the Chicago police yet? Come to Chicago this summer to oppose the death and Nakba coronation, aka the Democratic National Convention. These people want violence. They want disruption. And there should be no elected officials giving it any quarter whatsoever, because it threatens the public safety of the people of Chicago. And it threatens the public safety of visitors to our city at a time when we need to be like on our best behavior, showing the best face for the rest of the country. And yet you have people like Byron Cincho Lopez saying explicitly, we are going to be doing this with or without permits. That's wrong. He's inviting this.
And I will say this again. One of two people is going to win this presidential race this fall. And Joe Biden is going to be better for the Palestinian people than Donald Trump. Period. Full stop. There's no question about that. And in my mind, and I can't imagine anybody else's mind. And the idea that by somehow causing these great disruptions and bringing discredit onto the Democratic Party during this convention, go to Milwaukee where the Republicans are convening if you want to protest. But I think there's just so little strategic thinking. Like, they're going to shut down the war machine and break the imperialist grip on a society. No, they're not. They're just going to piss people off. They may cost Biden the election. I mean, you look back in 1968, there's a school of thought that says that all the tumult in 1968 in the Democratic convention here is what cost Hubert Humphrey the election. Where's the plan? Where's the real planning here except for, like, throw down with police? That's not going to give you any – it may give you some short-term satisfaction, Eric, or feeling of self-righteousness, but it's not going to advance your cause, which is you're going to – if you're going to make any progress at all, it's going to be through the Democratic Party and not through the Republican Party.
I have a TV in front of my microphone when I'm doing the show, and it's on mute, but I see
– We're that boring.
So I don't hear, but I see the Chyron. And all the news channels know that a lot of people watch their products with the volume off. So that's why you get all of those graphics and all those scrolling words. And all four of the networks I had up, News Nation, Fox News, CNN, and MSNBC, had the Chicago O'Hare protest on at the same time. And the words on the screen made it sound like this is a pro-Palestinian protest, and you didn't get a lot of nuance there. I'm just presenting to you the idea that protest might have been more successful than we're making it sound, because to people in Cleveland and Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, maybe the politicians in Washington, D.C., they see that our relationship with Israel is still too one-sided, and we need to push back and help the Palestinian people. And that's sort of the message that was glowing on my screen. So they don't give a rip about the people that are missing their flights in Chicago. That was hundreds and hundreds of people. They're talking to the world. You can argue that they were effectively getting that message across.
Well, you could maybe argue that the president has changed some of his stances on Israel and
because of stuff like this.
Cause. Because of the uncommitted votes in primaries in Michigan, maybe sending a message. I generally agree with the rest of you that it doesn't change minds. It just aggravates people. But making big news can elevate the cause. We're talking about it here on this podcast. You talk about it. I tend to agree that I think it just exacerbates whatever side you're on. If you don't like their cause anyways and you find them annoying, you want to swat them away like mosquitoes already, then you think that this just inflames their cause. If you are behind them, you say, go for it. And I don't think that it changes minds, but it may rally people to their corners more quickly.
But I think there's a great swath of the public that is in the middle on this, that they see the outrages that are going on in Gaza. They see the film clips. They hear about all the children who've been killed. And yet they also understand the history of Israel, and they understand the history of anti-Semitism in the world. And they understand that Israel is this beacon of comparative democracy compared to all the other states that surround them. And so people are conflicted. I hear accounts and arguments. I read both sides. I understand that there are. It's not just as simple as people like to portray it. I mean, there are all kinds of issues, and I'm not even really qualified to go into many of them. But I do know that there are a lot of people who are sort of wondering where they're going to fall on this. And if you end up pushing them away rather than drawing them to you with your arguments, I think you're ending up harming the cause that you're hoping to help.
I think the important part is that the people who are doing this don't care. They're not trying to win over the population's hearts and minds. it really is more important than just people getting to the airport this past weekend. Just as Austin was pointing out, this is basically a rehearsal for more to come with the Democratic National Convention. I'm sure you guys probably read a little bit about the organizing meeting that went on last weekend for the people who are going to be organizing against it. And it was pretty wild.
It was scary.
The one breakout session where people were taught how to chant death to America in Farsi because they all support Iran, because Iran is part of the alliance against Israel, which also includes us as the enemy. Alderman Sergio Lopez was also at that general meeting. I'm not saying he was at that specific portion of it, but he obviously knew that this meeting was also being put on by an alliance of groups who are extreme, who specifically want to disrupt and not protest legally.
Those are well thought out. I do feel a little bit like we are fanning the flames a little bit here. They went on the expressway for a little bit. They went off. It was super annoying. John, I heard you say something like, I think you said it in jest on air, that we have snowplows. That was the feeling in the moment, right? But like, we've stepped back a couple days. We've taken deep breaths. Yes, we have a national convention coming. I'm not saying things can't go wrong, but when did we get so afraid of protests in this country? This is part of what it is. I mean, I know, Austin, that their language is a lot different than peaceful protests that there's been, but there's always been factions on both sides on issues that want violence, that want terror, that want craziness to happen. And I'm not saying nothing can happen. Are we a little over worried here?
I think that's a fair point, John. I would also say that I think there is a difference between saying, you know, not using the language of peaceful protest and using the language of we're rejecting that because that doesn't work. And then we're going to have an elected official legitimize that. An elected official that's part of the body that is supposed to be keeping people safe saying, no, we're going to like mess some stuff up, but and it's going to be really ugly and potentially violent. It doesn't matter if this actually did change people's minds. That's beside the point. If January 6th, if that like was really good at changing people's minds, that wouldn't have made that okay because it was violent and undemocratic. And that's why this is not okay. And the fact that a sitting alderman can stand with groups like that, and it's so weird that he just keeps showing up at these really extreme, crazy things. Wow, like, oh man, that's odd that he keeps showing up at these places where it's like, I didn't know they were burning a flag. I didn't know they were saying death to Israel and death to America. I just keep showing up at stuff and people are saying,
what a coincidence.
Stop infringing on my First Amendment rights. You need to have adults in the room. The mayor should be saying, this is completely inappropriate. We shouldn't have an elected official here. The governor, his response to that was like, well, that's not something I would have said. That was his response.
That's very JB.
Lopez standing with these groups. And if, God forbid, there is something really bad that happens during the DNC and there is a lot of chaos and people get hurt, I think there's absolutely the leadership of the city to blame for that, for not speaking up sooner about why this is wrong.
My general objections were to our fear of general Gaza protests that have been happening. I think you make great points, and any elected official who emboldens that language should denounce it, and others.
Do we understand they're the same group, John? That is, the people that block the highway are, in fact, the people that want to disrupt the DNC? Do we know that it's the same cause, but maybe not the same MO or the same groups, right? I haven't heard them claim to be part of the DNC disruption group behind enemy lines.
The groups that I saw, and these are all, it's not like these groups have millions of dollars and like tons of, are issuing press releases all the time. So it's very hard to tell, like, are they the same group? I think it's very fair to say they probably have this similar mailing lists as all the other groups is kind of my impression. But I didn't see a direct, I'm sure many people who were involved in the O'Hare protests also happened to be at the Saturday event that Kate.
Oh, you think
brought.
So?
It was very discouraging about that Saturday event. I saw a clip from that, a video clip from that, where a speaker was on stage when he got word that Iran had been lobbing missiles into Israel, which he refuses to use the word Israel. He refers to it as Palestine. And the audience, she said, I just got word that Iran has attacked Israel. And the audience cheered. And I mean, that was sickening to me that they did that, because at the very, no matter which side you might be on, that is going to escalate hostilities. A lot of people, if that breaks into a regional war, which certainly that kind of attack threatened to, and I was like on edge on Saturday when, after that had happened, it seemed like things were very tense for about 24 hours. Lots and lots of people are going to die. You're talking about genocide. If that breaks into a big regional war, which a bunch of countries get involved, you know, we already have, what, 25,000 people dead in Gaza? It'll be four or five times that. So people who claim to be concerned about human life and about genocide and about atrocities need to keep that in mind when they're cheering Iran at attacking Israel. I mean, that is, I don't know.
Disgusting. What really surprised me was when those people were pulling their suitcases, trying to get to the gate for their flights at the airport. They ended up walking right by the people that had been blocking off the road, the pro-Palestinians. I can't believe that it didn't come to fisticuffs. You know, you could see them kind of yelling at him or barking at him, but I'm surprised that physical violence. We got road rage for people just cutting each other off on the Kennedy.
If you got to catch a flight, you're not going to go fight someone.
I know I would, but I don't have time. I'm trying to get to my gate. I guess that was the only thing that saved those fools, because the police were standing right there, too. John, they did eventually arrest him, but it was 2.5 hours that thing was locked up. I don't understand what took him so long.
Yeah, I don't get it either. Because I generally feel like people think of some of these protesters as flies and mosquitoes instead of an actual
movement,
or maybe not an actual movement. I think most people are just like, okay, and that's kind of how I feel about it. I support their right to protest peacefully and lawfully in every way they want to do it. Even people that cheer for Iran attacking Israel, that is abhorrent, but they are okay. They can say that. It gets to my ultimate point. Someone sits on the expressway. You put them in the back of a paddy wagon. It's good press for them. Makes them look more sympathetic to their cause, and it makes people be able to drive to the airport. I don't get why it takes so long.
Well, that would be nice. But, you know, I mean, we have not seen the police handle any really big violent outbreaks that we've seen in the last few years, right? I mean, like with Lori Lightfoot, I sort of understood the first wave of rioting and looting that went on. I thought, all right, I feel that they should have had a plan in place. But okay. This hasn't happened here in 40 years or whatever, so okay. But then it happens again a few months later, and they're still not ready for it, right? And
they being the police in Chicago.
Chicago police still had no plan in place to be able to deal with the rioting and looting that was going on in the Loop and spreading out to all the neighborhoods. They had no plan in place.
I'll bet they're rehearsing now.
Yes. I hope so. But, you know, if they can't even handle these people on the expressway in this isolated place, I find it worrisome.
Chicago got good marks with the G7.
Yeah, they did.
Remember that?
Right. Yeah, they did.
I managed to keep the protests.
That was a huge show of power.
And I think they're going to have to do that this time. And they are ready for it, I would hope. They certainly have enough warning to have some plans in place. But the idea that the city seems to have, or that who's got the plan, but that they're going to cordon off the United Center is going to be a fairly large security perimeter around that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that just pushes the protests downtown or out into the neighborhoods or into the parks. I'm not sure. But they have got to be really planning out. My guess is they probably have a number of people who are inside, undercover in these organizations, trying to figure out where they're going to go and what they're going to do. I would hope they would have that going.
I saw what I thought was the police rehearsing for some sort of crowd control maneuvers. There is a convoy downtown here by the radio station at Columbus and Wacker of 30 bicycles, 30 of them. I counted them as they went by, and they had a couple of different uniform type personnel, but they were all police officers, and there was a convoy of 30 bicycles weaving around traffic, somebody barking out instructions or strategies or something. And I suppose they'll need to use all kinds of resources this summer. It is another week in Chicago and another conversation about police shooting. This week, Eric Zorn did a Zapruder-like analysis of the Dexter Reed traffic stop, and he caught some hell for it at the Picayune Sentinel. I might also point out, by the way, that the chief administrator for the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, Andrea Kirsten, has been criticized this week for talking so much about the investigation. In fact, a Tribune editorial singled out her coming on my radio show, as well as Stephen A. Smith's podcast, of all things. Personally, I think she has been reserved in her judgment about the actions of the officers last month where Dexter Reed was shot, though she has lent credence to the skepticism about the reason for the stop itself. The cops say he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. Eric, what else should we know about that story? What are you hearing?
Well, what I did was I took a look at a surveillance video that was taken from about a block and a half, maybe two blocks away from where the traffic stop actually occurred. And I first saw it, I got to say, on the CWB Chicago crime blog. That's the only place that I saw this video. And what it shows, as you see, Dexter Reed's vehicle is in the middle of three cars at an intersection, a red light. Then the red light changes, the green light goes, and one of the cars turns right, and then he is in the lead of two cars, two white cars. They're about 100, 200 feet up the block when all of a sudden you see the police SUV coming in from the left of the screen at 90 degrees from the direction of travel. It takes a hard left turn, and then it overtakes the car behind Dexter Reed and then pulls Dexter Reed over. I don't see any way, if you look at this film, that you can say, oh, they must have seen that he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. They were too far away from him to see whether he had a seatbelt on. And I people have been piling on me about making a big deal of this. Like, what difference does it make? You know, he was carrying a gun. He's the kind of guy who shot cops. He was, you know, they good riddance to him and so on. But part of policing, a big part of policing, is establishing trust with the community and being honest when these kind of things happen and being transparent. And if they pulled him over because they recognized his vehicle or they had gotten a tip, then fine. But to say that they were pulling him over because of a seatbelt violation, it looks like a lie. And that's what Andrea Kirsten's been saying. And I don't think she's irresponsible for saying that. And Superintendent Snelling was talking about it being irresponsible. And I'm saying, well, look, dude, it's been 3 weeks now. It's been more than 3 weeks since this happened. Don't you have any idea why they pulled him over? Or can you prove that it was a seatbelt violation? Is that what they're saying? I just don't understand why. I mean, this era of transparency, we guess that they learned something from Laquan McDonald, not covering it up for a year. But they've had a lot of time to get their story straight, and they don't seem to have it straight. And that's the kind of thing that breeds mistrust in police and creates the kind of friction in the community that gets somebody who's pulled over so frightened that he might pull out a gun because he doesn't know what's going to happen. He doesn't know who's going to lie about him. So I think it is important why that traffic stop was made. And that's why in the Picayune Sentinel, I pulled it apart frame by frame to show what happened and why the seatbelt violation is so unlikely.
It is good, of course, that they're not holding on to it like they did with Laquan McDonald, but the way they released the information just created so much confusion. Now, you took that one video and broke it down on the Picayune Sentinel pretty easily, didn't you? Anybody with a laptop with the software that comes with it could probably have edited the videos from the various body cams and done some stop action, throwing in some arrows to show people what had happened, why they thought, for instance, that Dexter Reed had shot first. That's one of the big questions still out there. Instead, they just released the raw footage and nothing else and just leave everybody to scroll through all these different body cameras and try and figure out why did they think this? Why did they think that? And we're still trying to figure out right now, why do they think that they stopped them for a seatbelt? At the time, the way Andrea Kirsten was talking, she was making it sound like she had no idea where this information had come from. In her statements and in her interviews, you would never guess that she had something solid to pin that to. So every time I read or heard her speak, I was like, well, why is she saying it that way? Where is this information coming from? from.
Right. The information to me came through her first news release, first news release on the day that the video was released.
Right. But she said it in this very roundabout way. Like it was like, this is all we can figure is this is what they think. And it was
it has only been a few days since the incident. I mean,
it had been 2.5 weeks when they released the video. But that's enough time for Superintendent Snelling to come out and say, no, in fact, it wasn't a seatbelt stop. It was a taillight or whatever it was, or we had a tip, something. But that story was out there for several days, for at least 4 or 5 days.
But that assumes that it's not the truth, Eric. I mean, maybe they're standing by it was a seatbelt stop.
But then Snelling comes out on Friday and says it's irresponsible to say that.
Well, he was saying it was irresponsible for her to question that maybe the officers were lying. It's great that COPA released it on a relatively timely basis, but they could have done it in a more systematic way. They could have released it in video form where people could follow along and see what happened, plus the raw footage.
Should COPA have done that, or should the police department have done that? Should CPD or COPA?
I would say probably COPA is the one who released what is out there right now.
But it's not their video. I mean, I think this is a good idea. I think this is a good idea.
I got a lot of thoughts on this. I do think that we are... It's strange to say, we are lucky that we live in Chicago where COPA does have the power to access the police videos independently with their own login to the system. No other city has this where they don't have to ask police, please give us the videos, and expect them to be in full when likely they're edited. We are the only city that gets to right now go in there and grab these videos raw. Could it have come with a better presentation? Yes, but if you aren't in possession of all the facts, even arrows and slowdowns can imply things that maybe COPA doesn't have access to all the information in the current moment, right? I mean, COPA may not have all the answers. In fact, they probably don't. An investigation, a fuller investigation needs to happen, but you don't want to wait as you have people tweeting that there's some terrible video that's about to be released. How long is that? Because that was tweeted out all weekend long. Like, I hear there's a video that's going to come out, et cetera, et cetera. You can't have this linger on like in other cases. So I feel like it's not a perfect system, but I feel like it's gone fairly well in that we have all this video for news people to interpret, for other people to look at and make determinations on.
But they really just created a lot of chaos around people trying to interpret many, many different videos at the same time.
I agree with
right
that.
Now, I'm seeing on social media a poster for a protest tomorrow at CPD headquarters that very prominently says there's no evidence that he had a gun. So, like, they don't accept that Dexter Reed shot first. And part of that has to be that they did not, when they released this stuff, they did not give us any indication of how they know. And yet Andrea Kirsten, while she's saying she does not understand why they would have seen a seatbelt violation, she is stating very clearly that Dexter Reed shot first. How does she know that?
Well, the first gunshot you hear is muffled. It sounds different than the other 96 shots. That was
my interpretation. And you also see some smoke coming out of the window, and the cop who was shot, who was standing by the passenger window. I mean, I've looked at the videos too, Kate. I can't see that they just opened fire on him. I don't think they did.
Well, then how? If we can't agree on this, how is COPA supposed to come out with a?
Well, COPA apparently has some information because they are very, very specific that they believe that. They're not questioning it.
The poor judgment, I think, came not necessarily in what was said, but just the fact that you have an official that's responsible for the integrity and clarity of a rollout getting ahead of the investigation in some ways. They are mandated to release the footage, and I think it's good that the footage was released. I don't see the value add of an official then going on a tour talking to a lot of different organizations about anything beyond the footage that was released, and maybe basic questions about where they are in the process and procedure. And I think that was poor judgment. I also think that there's an opportunity. This is almost like the same thing with the Board of Elections that we were talking about a few weeks ago. But Chicago has a very complex now overlapping of many different organizations responsible for police accountability. And they tend to step on each other's toes a lot. You have COPA. You have the new police board. You have city council committees that are devoted to policing. You have the inspector general. There is a very good case, as is done in Los Angeles, that you really need to consolidate these things into one body. And that body is accountable for these sorts of things. Otherwise, you have too many cooks in the kitchen, I think, and you potentially run into a lot of situations like this. I really hope COPPA does learn from this, because I think this could have been done in a much better way. And I did think that Brandon Johnson and Snelling's joint statement was very well done. And I think very professional.
What did they say? What did they say, Austin?
Well, they expressed deep sympathy for people who were hurt and a person who lost his life. So I think Johnson had a line that I thought was very good, which was essentially like, either of these two men could have been my students. And it's a shame that this man is dead. It's also a shame and unacceptable that this police officer almost lost his life and was injured. And, you know, this is the process that we're going to be investigating this, full stop. I thought that was good. I don't know that it does the city well that then there is another official at COPPA going and saying things not even necessarily contradictory to that, but further complicating the picture.
Perhaps the annoying thing about this is that we're debating about this process as opposed to what actually maybe led to the stop. I mean, our colleague Pascal Sabino at Block Club has done so many stories about how pulling traffic stops are essentially the new stop and frisk in Chicago, that traffic stops in Chicago by police were under 100,000 in 2015, and they were over 600,000 in 2019, a four-year span, and you have six times as many traffic stops as you did before then. This is a tactic used by police to, for better or for worse, to find out more. And we're still trying to dig into, I want to know what's actually being said, even if there's no quota of pullovers, what each district has to get in a day. Is there an unspoken quota in commanders' meetings about how many pullovers police are supposed to be doing a day or a week? What do officers feel like their jobs really are as they patrol the streets? These are like really deeper questions that I think are way more important than the back and forth of, you know, maybe one person said one thing a little wrong or asked for clarification, whatever it is, which are legitimate points you guys are bringing up.
But John, do you think then that they should just throw out that video the way COPPA does and then let all of us interpret it? Let's forget about Andrea Kirsten for a second here from COPPA and just say, should we just leave it to the public to discuss amongst yourselves and we'll let you know when we find
I thought the one pager outlining things, maybe Kate is right that she could have clarified exactly how she knows this or how they came to this determination a little bit more. But yes, put all the videos out. We have 2579-1132, WGN, WLS, Block Club Chicago, Chicago Tribune, Sun-Times, Illinois Answers. We have a lot of people that look at these things and analyze them. We have a wealth of people that do this for a living to help us all interpret it. I don't need officials trying to explain or videos making with arrows and slow motions to videos that could doctor and influence people, independent journalists.
Wow.
Well, I think that's fair. I mean, that's what attorneys will do that in court, right? So that's like they will slow down things,
yes,
establish a narrative. And I do take John's point where it's like, give us the raw.
Absolutely. But also show us with some stop action, with an arrow if necessary, show us what you're telling us you so far have found. We didn't even really know if they pulled him over or was he just parked in the crosswalk pulled up. We didn't even know that. There were a lot of very simple things that could have been established.
Do we know that now? Kate?
We do know now from that CWB footage that Eric saw that they did pull him over.
They pulled
but
him
like,
over.
When Andrea Kirsten says something so specific as Dexter Reed shot first, but she's saying she thinks the cops are lying about other things, she should be showing us or at least telling us why she thinks that's true.
Yeah, I would be a both and kind of thing. I can see, and I've seen this in a lot of other situations around the country where the police will release an edited video. It's narrated sometimes with chyrons or something else, where they will kind of take you through the clips and from various angles and take you through the whole story. But then they will also just dump the raw stuff out there, and you go on the police site, the COPA site, there's all kinds of video that's like just basically worthless, and a bunch of audio like 911 calls from neighbors going, that has been shots fired, like, no, that's of no value to a journalist. But it all fits together, and you can go back and second guess them, and if you catch them cheating on that, I do think that the fundamental thing here is transparency, speed, trust, honesty. When those things are forefront, now maybe they are the traffic stops are the new stop and frisk, and maybe the cops will say, like, yeah, we see a young black man driving a white SUV, we're going to pull him over because we think there's a good chance in the neighborhood that he's got a gun. Well, if that's the case, then just say so, and we can debate the merits of that and say, is that something that we want to have happening? And maybe we do. I don't know. I mean, I don't think we do, but maybe we do. I know that it's a very large percentage of the population that gets pulled over are black and brown. I know that most of the stops, some very high percentage of these stops, result in nothing but maybe a citation or a warning for an actual violation, minor violation. So, let's be honest about what we're doing, what we're empowering the police to do. What do we want them to do? Maybe we want them to do this. Maybe this is going to be like the DUI stops, where we just like put up a roadblock and you got to be pulled over and your car's going to be searched for a gun. I don't know, but let's be honest about it. Let's talk about what's really going on.
You can't pull that car over just because you're guessing, right? Or even because you're suspicious of tinted windows on an SUV on the west side. I mean, you can't pull that vehicle over without some cause.
But that is a cause.
What? Having tinted windows on an SUV?
If it's too dark of a tinted window,
right,
yes.
Right. Well, there we go.
If police want to pull a car over, they have that desire to do so. It's not, you follow someone driving for 10 minutes, they're going to roll a stop sign or not come to a complete stop at a red light.
And
right?
They pull them over, yeah.
Right.
So we're going to move on.
Lightning round.
I know, okay. So everybody gets a sentence or two, but let's just at least touch on a couple of things. Eric, what are your thoughts about the ShotSpotter technology? I understand that as we have been sitting here recording this podcast, the ShotSpotter vote was delayed at the city council using a parliamentary maneuver by opponents. So they're not going to take it up today. But what should the city's position be on ShotSpotter technology, Eric?
I would defer in this case to Superintendent Snelling and to, I think, 14 of the 17 alders who have ShotSpotter in their wards who want to keep it there. And it seems to me, it's not in my ward, and I don't live with it either way, but my understanding is that there is a great sentiment in those communities and by the superintendent of police that ShotSpotter is an effective way to respond quickly to gunshots, to get to gunshot victims faster. And I think that Mayor Johnson made a mistake in preemptively doing this without really consulting the stakeholders, as I say, and doing that. So I think that they ought to keep it in the wards that want it.
Kate is flummoxed that Brandon Johnson appointed Marlene Hopkins to head the buildings department. Why is that even on your radar?
Because I grew up on the Southwest Side, which is, and was, when I was a child, even more so, a toxic waste dump in many spots. Anyway, so I was pretty surprised when Brandon Johnson nominated for building commissioner Marlene Hopkins, who had been deputy commissioner, because she was found by the inspector general, who was done Joe Ferguson, to be the person responsible for not having a plan in place and seeing that it was followed when the Crawford coal plant smokestack got imploded in Little Village, blanketing the whole area with a horrific dusting of ashes. There's a class action settlement lawsuit going on now. I think they're going to get about $12.5 million for the local people. I don't know what that's going to really do for them, frankly, at this point. She was found responsible for that. That was her. That happened on her watch. She was directly responsible for it. Marlene Hopkins has never commented on it. She was nominated by Brandon Johnson to be the permanent building commissioner. He did not bring that up, certainly, in his statement about that. At her confirmation hearing this week, not a single person brought it up or asked about it. It just seems wrong.
Austin, I'll ask you this, although it's something that Eric brought up. Some voices are calling on Joe Biden to refuse to debate Donald Trump. Eric wrote, "My view is that the only thing worse than giving Trump a debate platform would be seeming to be afraid to debate him. What would you advise Joe Biden to do about a debate? No debates, one debate, as many as everybody wants to schedule?
So on one side, you would say, yeah, he might look afraid. On the other hand, you're giving Trump more oxygen. And in a debate context, although, you know, you could say anything you want about Trump's debate style being obnoxious and boorish, to a great swath of the voting public, he's going to look better and probably more with it and on his feet than Joe Biden. So it's highly risky. It's really risky to do. And I would probably lean towards not doing it.
Yeah.
And Biden should talk directly to voters rather than talking directly to voters with Trump.
Well, he certainly would have the defense of saying, well, Mr. Trump refused to debate any of his primary opponents, so he can't really be calling anybody a chicken for not debating him at this point. But the truth is that candidates who feel like they have a big lead don't necessarily want to give oxygen to their opponents. That happens all the time. And if you're on the other side, you always get indignant. And if you're on the side of the candidate that's way out in front, you're like, yeah, I understand that. I just think that Trump will play that for all it's worth about, you know, Chicken Joe, and it's going to be Sleepy Joe, Chicken Joe, Crooked Joe. He's, I mean, all the nicknames that he gives, he's going to add another one. I think Biden, if Biden can't go toe-to-toe with Trump, and maybe he's going to look bad. Austin might be right. If he can't go toe to toe with Trump, then I got a problem with him. I mean, I'll vote for him either way, of course. But I think there are going to be voters who will see that as a weakness, and weakness is one of the things that is the criticism of Biden, that he's not a strong president, and Trump is a strong leader despite all of his flaws. So I think he's got to do it.
I would maybe do just one then. Although Joe Biden, in my estimation, did outperform at the State of the Union this year. I didn't think he could deliver as strong or stirring a speech as he did. That's not a debate, and the rules get broken during debates left and right. But I do think Joe Biden did well in the last big public performance, and I would say maybe one debate. One more subject for you guys. Camila Cardoso and Angel Reese, representing almost 13 feet of basketball talent, are coming to Chicago. Both played on the last two women's NCAA championship basketball teams. Now, neither of them are Caitlin Clark, but Reese is almost as famous, and ticket sales at Wintrust Arena are brisk. In fact, on the secondary market right now, to get a ticket to see Indiana and Caitlin Clark come to Chicago this summer, you'll pay anywhere from $225 to $1,700 a ticket. Austin, are you planning on going to any Sky games this year?
I would definitely go. And the most shocking thing about that, the whole draft story for me, was the salary of Caitlin Clark. Holy moly. It's like an entry level like job at a bank. She's getting paid like $75,000 a year or $80,000 a year.
Mascots at pro teams, NBA teams. Mascots at NBA teams get paid more than the first pick.
And is that due to the crazy salary cap rule that's in the WNBA, or why is that?
It's a function of the money that comes in. The NBA contract for TV is in the billions, and it's $60 million for the WNBA. The money. So I think it's easy to get outraged. It's, to me, just a curious fact of the economics of it all. There's no crime here. It's just that the numbers are all smaller, and the league is younger, and they play half as many games.
I will go, and I would encourage other people to go, because this is really the saving grace of Wintrust Arena as a public sector investment that has gone completely haywire.
Right. Let's do it for the venue.
John, the reason, there's all these projections. We should go back and look at these. The projections on DePaul men's basketball attendance at the Wintrust Arena are some of the craziest things I've ever seen. I mean, it was like, we're going to be packing this thing for DePaul men's basketball.
You brought up a very sore subject with John.
And I have written and spoken at length about how my heart goes out to the cheerleaders, because there's nobody there. Eric, are you going to go to a game?
Yeah, I went last year to a game, and it was not very well attended. I am a little skeptical of this draft. They have drafted two bigs. Both Cardoso and Reese are down low players in a league that tends to be more spread out and more reliant on the 3-point shot. And neither of them are 3-point shooters. They lost Kalia Copper because they couldn't get the proper trade. I'm not sure the team's going to be all that good this year, actually, that they're still rebuilding. But I think this is an artifact of all the excitement that has been brewing about Caitlin Clark, and that she has brought this new attention to women's basketball, which is great. And the games that we saw in the tournament were great. And I think it's going to be an exciting year for the Sky, but I don't think they're going to be all that good this year. But yeah, I'll go. And I think the starting salary is really small. But John, you're right. As they play half the number of games, and they just don't have the TV contracts. I don't think that the owners of the Sky or these other teams are getting way richer than, say, NBA owners. I think it's a business, and these are business decisions, and the salary caps and all those things are all based on how much money has been coming in. I'm hoping and guessing that money is going to skyrocket with this new popularity, and that you're going to see the more money coming in and the players getting the same kind of cut, because I think right now they get basically the same cut of revenues that NBA players get. It just happens to be a whole lot smaller.
Well,
right,
the league
now
isn't even profitable. Is that what you guys are telling me in the booth, that it's been 27 years that league's been in operation and the league is a not profitable entity? Remember, the teams were first the sort of stepchildren of the NBA teams. They're on their own now. They no longer have that affiliation, but they just don't have the revenue. Kate, are they going to get some of your dollars at the gate?
No, not a single one. I don't watch sports. Don't. My husband watches all the sports. I'm a White Sox fan who just goes once or twice a year if it's nice weather. I'm just
this out. This is just pathetic. We have a White Sox fan and a DePaul basketball fan on the same podcast. This is just terrible. The White Sox have the worst start in franchise history, which goes way back.
MLB history, depending on the metric you're looking at.
Well, that doesn't help either. I think it is a wonderful thing what's going on, of course, with the huge surge in the popularity, but not because somebody like Caitlin Clark gets to make some money. I cannot get outraged about the low salary. I do think that is just a function of economics. I spend way more time feeling outraged about the insane salaries in the NBA, NFL. The amount of money those guys make is so crazy. But when you come right down to it, it's entertainment.
If you want to feel sad, John, about DePaul, so 10,000 seats at Wintrust Arena.
Yeah.
The economic wizards that projected this amazing windfall for the city of Chicago predicted average attendance at the DePaul men's basketball games of 9,500 fans per game.
They haven't had that before. They have not had that once. They have not had. Well, I've only gone 4 years, but they haven't had it one time. Not one time. I've been there when they've had 1,900 people, not 9,000. And I'm not kidding. I feel sad for the cheerleaders. The Sky are the Blackhawks right now. Young talent that is not going to win as many games in the next season as you'd like to, but it's going to be fun to watch maybe this thing grow. And that's my hope. And that's our podcast. Austin, good to see and hear you. Ditto Kate Plies, Eric Zorn. John Hansen had to click out. I'm sure he would have had something to say about all of that. Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman are our producers. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
That was fun.
See you around.
All right, guys.
Hey, bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.